Hello, my name is James Trupany and welcome to Telling Stories. Today, we're going to start a series called The Rough Guide to Violence, which I wrote for WrestleTalk TV a number of years ago, around about 2015. This was a series that was really important to me to tell the story of hardcore wrestling and to give a bigger insight into the history of it and to look at the cities that were really important to hardcore wrestling, because there's a very specific thread through this series, as you'll notice, of industrial heartlands turning into hardcore violence centres. This first part of the story looks back to some old charges of the violence days, the very early hardcore heroes. It's called Motor City Madness, and as you can imagine, it's based in the city of Detroit. A Rough Guide to Violence, Motor City Madness. You can tell a lot about major American cities by their sports teams. Buffalo gained a reputation as being a loser's town after losing the Super Bowl 4 years in a row in the late 80s and early 90s. Of course, they were not really losers. 4 American football conference titles are nothing to be sniffed at, but high-profile losses like that set the tone of underachievement. The fans of Buffalo kept believing and keep trying, and maybe one day they will get there. Oakland has a team of cocky outlaws in the Raiders that every inch the image of their founding owner, the late Al Davis's vision. If you walk around their training ground or their stadium, you'll see the signs that say, "Commitment to Excellence," and the fans' own "Welcome to the Black Hole" by their rabid hardcores, and the ever-present "Just Win, Baby." It gave his team, the fans and the city, a reflective level of confidence and helped them to 3 Super Bowl titles in the 70s and 80s. They even shipped that attitude with them when they moved to LA and shipped it back to Oakland, and soon will ship it to Las Vegas. Detroit has a sterling sports reputation, most notably in baseball. It also has a good at football once, an NFL title in 1936. However, it is ice hockey where Detroit has excelled to the point the city, on the back of the Red Wings' success, wanted to run the promotion Hockey Town USA. No knock on the Tigers, who have been a dependable draw, nor the trio of NBA titles that went to the Pistons in the late 80s, but it's hockey that really sums up the town. The Red Wings have had long stretches of dominance, and it matches a tough, gritty, diverse city that was forged in the factories of Ford and General Motors, with a tough and gritty, sometimes violent sport. Guys who worked hard in the week wanted some hard-going entertainment, and it's that kind of down-to-earth working-class attitude that would bring together a truly individual wrestling territory, and which would be incredibly influential in many other companies around the world. The Detroit territory began in the pre-NWA era and was originally owned by Nick Londis, who ran the Olympia, which seated 15,000 people, and an early home to the Red Wings back in the 20s. During the 20s, the foundation for national corporation had barely been put in place, and it was a period of great instability even in the wrestling hotbed of North America, the Midwest. All the farm boys, college athletes, and young hopefuls between Des Moines and Omaha were being brought to the big cities in advancing numbers, keen to make a big payoff in Chicago and Detroit. It looked as if the Midway may take hold of the pro wrestling game altogether, as its product, Rough Hometowners, caught the attention of the money-buying public. Even Jack Curley, renowned boxing and wrestling promoter of New York, started to take his money to the newly booming industrial heartlands. Adam Weismuller then took over the territory and things began to move more towards the wrestling we know of today. However, with no national controlling body and promoters as ever desperate to be doing things better than the guys over the hill, power plays were bound to happen. The biggest nationally recognized champion at the time was the National Wrestling Association champion. The title was controlled and managed by St. Louis promoter Tom Pax. The belt had a direct lineage back to George Hackenschmidt's first world title reign and is such commanded respect when drawing power. So when Wichita promoter Billy Sandow came to Adam Weismuller and Chicago promoter Fred Kohler with the idea as the syndicated to break Pac's 20-year grip in the Midwest, it seemed like a good deal. It gave them an edge for a while, helping them take control from Pax. However, Sandow was not to be trusted, and he sold his rights to their title to Pax. It would be the next generation of promotional corporation that bust the Midwest open, right at the birth of the NWA, and more importantly, the TV era just after the Second World War, that would really gear up Detroit and the rest of the country to what could be done with wrestling and television. After Weismuller left the promotion, it took 10 years for the Detroit office to settle down. Louis Markowitz would try next. New York kingpin Jack Pfeffer would try too. You think the national idea was Duke Vince Jr.'s idea? He was only the manifest destiny of what New York had been trying to do subtly for years. Pfeffer and Sandow's Goldust trio partner Ed the Strangler Lewis tried his hand. Marty Feldman and Jacques Giroux had regular operations, and Fred Kohler expanded outwards from Chicago to take all the market he could. However, by the early 40s, Weismuller's assistant Harry Light would take up the reins. The Harry Light wrestling office would take control of Motor City, and thanks to the war, he had a depleted roster ripe for some new stars to emerge. One of its new stars would set the tone for the rest of Detroit's NWA run. Wild Bill Curry was something else. From a Lebanese immigrant family at the age of 16, he joined the carny circuit as a circus tough man. Undoubtedly learned in the ways of hooks and shoots that all carny specialists knew, he could look after himself in genuine contests. He apparently never went longer than 5 minutes in his 65-fight career. As happens with lot with Curry, the truth is often enhanced, but to quote Hollywood film director John Ford, when the truth becomes legend, print the legend. He then moved to Hartford, Connecticut, his hometown, to become a policeman, where his reputation, both real and promotionally imagined, became larger than life. By the time he arrived in Detroit, he had a reputation as a hooker, a brawler, and a general all-round tough guy. Then he met Adam Weissmuller, and things would take a change for the apocryphal. Adam Weissmuller knew a thing or two about promotion. Adam Weissmuller knew a thing or two about the promotion of formerly legit sports stars. After all, his nephew was Tarzan actor and former Olympic swimmer Johnny Weissmuller. He must have seen dollar bills flash before his eyes when he saw Curry walk through the door. 6 foot tall and a natural 220 pounds, he had all the attributes of a good heavyweight at the time. He was tough, athletic, and as ugly as sin. One should not be so judgmental about a man's looks, but the thick, heavy eyebrows, a result of his Middle Eastern roots, went untrimmed and bushed up. But his look screamed deranged and unstable. Weissmuller took one look and realized a persona that would stand Curry in good stead, that of Wild Bill Curry. By the end of the 1930s, he was a surefire hit at the Gardens Arena. It was him, not the pure wrestler Orville Brown, or many others that could have been chosen from the wrestlers affiliated to the Detroit office, that challenged former heavyweight champion Jack Dempsey in an exhibition match. Weissmuller found himself a star, the cornerstone of promotion right up until he sold out and handed over to Harry Light. What he didn't realize was he had found the key to success, the Detroit formula. Have one incredible, charismatic, and terrifying heel, and have him be oppressively dominant for years on end. Curry was not just a hit in Detroit. In fact, the most impressive era of his career would come in Dallas, Texas. And while this doesn't sit well for my Detroit narrative, if we are going to tell the story of violence in pro wrestling, it has to start somewhere, and Curry was the mainstream hardcore star. While his ring style was not spectacular as the draws to come along in the 60s and 70s, he was the paradigm of efficiency. One big bump to grab attention, and then straight to the small and sharp foreign objects. Essentially, he looked intense, could brawl, and considered the rules a minor inconvenience to his advancement. And boy, was he over. Like, scary over. And thanks to Wikipedia, his achievements in terror are listed below. In one case, he scared a girl at ringside so badly, she had to be carried away from the ring in terror. In 1955, a match between Curry and Ray McIntyre resulted in more than 140 fans being taken to hospital after a riot broke out. And in 1956, Curry was jumped by a fan who was displeased with Curry's brutal treatment of local star George Becker. Curry broke the fan's jaw with a single punch. In 1958, during a match with Pepper Gomez in Alveston, Texas, a fan struck Bill Curry with an iron pipe. Curry chased the fan out of the ring, catching up with him in the balcony where he beat him up. And in 1968... Yes, 1968. While wrestling Emil Dupree in Worcester, Massachusetts, a fan jumped in the ring and jumped on Curry's back. Curry punched the fan so hard, he was reportedly unconscious for 2 days. These are just the verifiable stories. The one from when he was a policeman in Hartford, that a bull got loose from a stockyard, and Officer Curry apparently grabbed it by the horns and rode it to the ground, that was probably made up. But a good read nonetheless, just right for a guy heading to Texas. When he got there, the good folks at the Lone Star embraced him. In a repulse, kind of, we hate you, but we got you, watch you kind of way, just as much as the Northern Industrials had. So much so that it gave Southwest Sports Incorporated a problem. They really couldn't run Curry at the top of the card every night. It's been widely known for years that too much violence means an eventual downturn in business. Ordinarily, the key would have been to loan him out to elsewhere. However, the Texas Brain Trust came up with a novel and very successful solution. They created the NWA Texas Brass Knuckles Championship, Dallas version, purely with Curry in mind. His reliance on weapons and brawling tactics became the focus of a division, and the challenges for it made it a much anticipated and defended title. Curry won it 20 times in a 14-year period. The title was so successful, versions of it cropped up in the Amarillo office, Florida, and Mid-Atlantic. The athletically mindful Carolina fans never truly went for it. It also had a lasting influence on the later day hardcore promotion that we will get to in a few weeks. Curry's low bump rate and reliance on weapons was a celebration of the low risk. He got by in his ability to draw heat, not his wrestling prowess. Wikipedia also beautifully describes his finishing maneuver as a punch in the face. What that had in mind, he managed to keep a ridiculously long career together simply by brawling, cheating, and being essentially evil. As the 50s turned into the 60s, it turned out that Evil had a son called Flying Fred Curry. He was actually a clean-cut, white-meat babyface. No good kids, defying their parents, being all rebellious. Still in Texas, Fred and Bill began a tag team that was one of the early NWA International Tag Team Champions. A pair of belts now forms the double cup in AJPW. They held the belt for nearly 2 years. He would of course vacate back to his initial home territory, where he found a man following in his footsteps with an equally maniacal grin who had taken over the hot seat as Detroit's star attraction, the one, the only, the original Sheik. In 1949, the biography of Ed Fahat read thusly. One of 10 children born to Lebanese immigrant parents, he was 4 when the Great Depression struck America. He served his country in the U.S. Army towards the tail end of the Second World War and played football at Michigan, a high-profile Wolverine long before the Steiner brothers. A pretty remarkable life before he got to the wrestling ring, but remarkable doesn't begin to describe the pro wrestling career of the original Sheik. The native Lansing, Michigan, changed the North American wrestling model, created a raft of imitators, and set several careers in motion. He was reviled, beloved, and hated on both sides of the Pacific, wrestled well into his 70s, and proved to be an incredible draw for 5 decades. As a Michigan native, it was obvious to start in what now had become the wrestling hotbed in Detroit. Obviously, having watched Curry and seen what could be done with the Monster Heel gimmick, he took it a step further. Applying his Middle Eastern roots, he portrayed himself as a rich Syrian carpetbagger, coming in to steal the matches and titles of the American homegrown talent. He originally used the name The Sheik of Araby after the 20s hit song of the same name by Harry B. Smith and Ted Snyder. Essentially, though, it boiled down to The Sheik, except no imitations. He protected his character incredibly tightly throughout his career to keep his aura in place. Even his family called him Uncle Sheik, and he never ever spoke English in public. Of course, he couldn't speak the native Syrian tongue of his character either, and projected his communication through pidgin Arabic noises. In the early part of his career, he'd be accompanied by the slave girl, the Princess, actually his wife Joyce. But as she moved down to promotion and to look after the growing family, he needed a voice. Initially, it would be Ernie Roth in the early part of his career, at the time portrayed as Abdullah Farouk. Now there's some wrestling history to those two names, but more on them later. He'd be the one to give the message of the Sheik, and the message was hatred. Roth would, of course, use all he had learned from Fahat to become the Grand Wizard of wrestling and be the driving heel force behind the WWF, but his initial fame came in Detroit. If you haven't seen a Sheik match, I can tell you the basic premise in a couple of lines. Enter the ring with a great ceremony, usually with some form of prop, like a snake or a prayer mat, preferably both. Give praise to Allah in the TV bouts against enhancement talent. This often took longer than the actual match. Then he would set about his opponent with gusto, gurgling, biting and scraping, and a hidden weapon, usually a pencil wrapped in athletic tape, possibly for grip or so that the crowd could see it better and to conceal the hidden blade to give nice clean cuts. If that didn't work, his curled boots, which were loaded, would do the trick. Every sneak attack, every referee blindside, every cowardly beg-off would then ensue, expertly applied to gain the most out of the audience and enhance that sneak attack, the finish, depending on the opponent, of course, would be the camel clutch, applied until submission. And if all that didn't work, then it was time to start throwing fire. His much-heralded fireball technique, touch paper and a lighter, was so well done commentators were able to protect it as throwing fire from the open hand, nothing short of a miracle in front of the wrestling fans' eyes. It all sounds very basic. With a little smoke and mirrors, and it was, but the Sheik knew how to get the best out of every very little. The act, of course, was of its time, horribly dated, and it would not swing in a major promotion of any kind now. It really can't be construed as racist, a man of Arabian descent playing an Arabian character to its extremes, but what it was doing was preying on the sense of otherness and the rejection of anything within the society's accepted norms, and the Sheik played that up to the hilt. It was a mainstream hit, at least in Detroit, and it turned out that many other places too. It's important to note, as Jim Cornette did in his profile of the Sheik for FSM magazine, is that all of this happened under 10 minutes, and it happened to whomever he was in with the ring with, jobber or star, though the star's comeback would obviously be a bit stronger. The match pattern, with a few tweaks, would happen every time. The slow opening grabbed your attention because it was so different, and when he had you fascinated, he would go out of his way to scandalize you into watching more. A shock and awe wrestler born for the TV era, as his short but impactful matches could be shown in their entirety and grab fans as they flick through the channels. The Sheik's initial success led him to be a wanted man by promoters. In those early travels, he would build relationships that would carry his career. He would move to West Texas, the Amarillo office, then still being booked by the Funk family. In his 2 years there, he turned the charity on its head and brought the business so far up that the Funk clan were always glad to work with him. It was there he met one of his key opponents, who would shape the Detroit territory over the next 20 years, Bobo Brazil. They met for the first time in the ring, but on his entrance the Sheik noticed something that irked him. Texas, a slave state before the Civil War, was still segregated in the late 50s. The venue in question put the black audience up in the gods behind chicken wire, probably the venue rather than the promotion. He decided to do something about it. Climbing out of the ring, he clambered up into the black section and tore the chicken wire down. Being the Sheik, the crowd bought into it as another wild Sheik act, but it had a purpose, an unencumbered view of the ring for the black audience. When he returned to the ring, Bobo caught him in the headlock and asked him what he was doing. Proclaiming how much he hated racism, he explained that he had done it to give the black fans a better view. The pair began to laugh themselves silly while trying to cover their giggles at their act of bravado. It set up a lifelong friendship that the Sheik would make good on a few years down the line, but for now he was an Amarillo star attraction. With the main event status came main event responsibilities, and that meant taking on the NWA heavyweight champion when he came to town, who happened to be one Aloysius Martin Luthez, premier hooker and sufferer of no fools. Realizing Fahat had risen to the top awfully quickly as a gimmick man, he perhaps needed putting in his place. He informed Fahat that he would break both his legs. The Sheik, realizing he was outgunned in every way possible, Lou was more than capable of breaking every bone in Fahat's body should he have wanted to, pulled a trick that looked ridiculous in the outset, but was actually promotional genius. He ran away. Running out to the parking lot, he found a truck and hid under it for 3 hours. Of course, for a World Championship heavyweight title match, the World Wrestling and local mainstream press were there, and they followed the story and publicised it widely. The Sheik had managed to do something no one had before. He got over by doing nothing at all. At least the exact opposite of what he was expected of him. The wrestling public was fascinated. Lou, for his part, was somewhat bemused and congratulated Fahat when he met them years later, stating it was one of the bravest things he'd ever seen in wrestling, because it could have gone so horribly wrong. He was now a made man, and his reputation grew as he headed back home to Detroit, where things had moved on somewhat. The ownership of the NWA office had moved into Jim Barnett and Johnny Doyle. Barnett would move on to Georgia Championship Wrestling and be a key player in the development of the territory, but for now, he and Doyle sold out to Ed Fahat and his partner Francis Fleischer. They had the template in place for the successful Detroit promotion from years before, and Adam Wuzmeiler. A charismatic, violent and wild heel matched up against a long-term foe, only this time, as Cornette puts it, Fahat was driving the train and could do exactly as he wanted without restraints of the promoters. They obviously had the Sheik as the main attraction. They needed a long-term on-again, off-again face opponent who could wrestle up and down the card and with a long-term goal of unseating the monster. Remembering his acquaintance with Bobo Brazil, he was brought into the territory, and a feud that would take 10 years to blow off was made. Bobo was born with the God-given wrestling name, Houston Harris. However, he was promoted in a manner that accentuated his African heritage, perhaps a little too much for modern tastes. The finisher was called the Cocoa Butt. But it worked for its time and for its region. Initially called Boo Boo, thankfully a promoter had put a misprint in a poster and Bobo stuck. Standing at 6'6" and weighing 270 to 300 pounds, he was a dominant physical presence, just the man to stop the Sheik in his tracks. Eventually, you understand, these things take time. While he didn't work exclusively for Detroit, it was here that most of the famous feud of his career would occur. It was over the Detroit version of the NWA US Heavyweight title. The pair would make the belt famous, but it would be the Sheik who would hold it for the most. The key to his success being oppression. While it wasn't exactly what the Detroit fans wanted, it was what made the territory rock for the early 60s to the late 70s. The Sheik would be the dominating force, and occasionally Bobo would get the upper hand and the title, gaining some short-lived relief for the fans. Bobo really shouldn't be classed only in terms of his relationship with the Sheik. He was responsible for the breaking of many barriers. His presence and likable character made him a big hit. He was one of the first high-profile black headliners who, along with his other main rival, Big Cat Ernie Ladd, in fact, the pair would induct each other into the WWE Hall of Fame in 94 and 95. Bobo's style was more classical than the Sheik's for sure, though he was a powerhouse and not exactly a mat mechanic. It didn't really matter. It was his portrayal of an upright, standout sporting figure that appealed to the Detroit fans who understood his work ethic, and a lot of them also connected with his race. After the Second World War, the factories of Detroit turned once again to making cars and trucks rather than tanks, but thanks to the war, the working population of Michigan had taken a big hit. Sociologists call this period of black American history the Great Migration, as southern black families and individuals moved north by the thousand to form, for the first time, a true black working class. In Chicago, it meant Muddy Waters, Howling Wolf, Chess Records, and the birth of electric blues. In Detroit, it meant John Lee Hooker and Bobo Brazil. For big-time professional wrestling, the company now running Detroit, for Hart and Flesher. It meant tapping into new, and thanks to the economic circumstances of Detroit, an ever-expanding audience. The Sheik and Bobo were the overarching narrative of Detroit for the next 10 years, but in the meantime, understanding that a change is as good as a rest, especially if you don't want to turn the fans off entirely with nothing but violence, the Sheik and Bobo would travel to wrestle each other or other people. Having established themselves in Detroit, they grew into big draws coast to coast. Perhaps the biggest call of them all came from Vince McMahon Sr. when he brought the Sheik into New York to challenge Bruno Sammartino for the WWF Championship. The Sheik popped the territory in an inconclusive three-match series. New York hadn't seen anything like the Sheik, and it despised him for it. He would also be a big hit in Toronto, headlining nearly 150 shows in his truly hottest period between the late 60s and early 70s, and was undefeated in every one. As with every streak, though, as we have come to see this year, with The Undertaker, when it ended, it had a detrimental effect on business. Andre the Giant, on his first North American tour, was booked for the main event. The Sheik threw a fireball at him before the first 2 minutes were up, and the match ended in a countout, which nearly killed the Toronto territory in the ensuing years. Realising perhaps they shouldn't actually win them all, the Sheik adjusted his ways and became slightly less invincible as he went along. But the importance of keeping his aura never left him. Bobo wasn't the whole story in Detroit either. The film I Like to Hurt People was made when the Detroit territory was at its height in the mid-70s, even though it wasn't released until 1985. Though parts of it are hilariously bad, and so kayfabe heavy now, it's a mesmerizing trip down memory lane, but the characters are there, and it proved it happened. Dusty Rhodes, the Funks, they all came to Detroit for a big payday in Cobo Hall. His wild brawling style would also catch on in Japan. His biggest and most important feud for himself and his opponents would be against the Funk brothers Terry and Dory Jr. Catching on in old Japan with Giant Baba's request, they had a match that blew expectations of what wrestling could be in Japan and made the Funks faces for the first time, starting a love affair between the brothers and the country, which 40 years later is showing no signs of abetting. This opened the door for all Gaijins to break that barrier. Previously, under Ricky Dozan's guidance, all foreign visitors had widely been portrayed as bad guys. When you had the Sheik partnered with Abdullah the Butcher, though, it was hard to make that stick. A match recently posted by Dory Funk Jr. himself on Twitter tells you the story ably enough. Dory was set to wrestle the Sheik, who was in the middle of this opening routine when Terry came down to ringside, who had been jumped by the Sheik prior to the match. He was bleeding from his ear, and as the claret rolled down his chest, he made the motion to say the Sheik had a foreign object in his boot. Enraged as the bell rang, it was Dory who took it to the Sheik. The chain wrestling purist who made an art form the 1 hour Broadway and who could keep crowds on the edge of their seats with a hammerlock began throwing anything that wasn't nailed down into the ring. Chairs, tables and the Sheik himself was hurled through or over the top rope. Abdullah the Butcher came down to second the Sheik and hand off one of his missing taped up pencils. Then it got crazy as Terry joined the fray and sent the heels packing. It lasted less than 5 minutes, but the Funks were now heroes, setting up a much anticipated tag match that sealed the beginning of their Japanese legacy. It wasn't the end of the story for the Sheik by a long way, but by the late 80s, slower moving, slightly more spread around the middle, and heading towards his mid-50s, the tyranny that had served him so well began to fade in the eyes of the fans. The Detroit territory never fully recovered, and it closed its doors in 1980. Becoming an independent promoter, the Sheik carried on, and he would find a new place in the 1980s and 90s. But we shall return to him and the last act of his career in a future episode. Next week, we'll move on to many other territories, and another master brawler who favoured the ideology of talk softly and carry a white-taped sharp foreign object. The madman from Sudan, Abdullah the Butcher. Telling Stories is part of the Troopany Show podcast network channel. You can find us on the internet at Troopany Show, The Troopany Show on Facebook. Theme song by Sheriff Lone Star and the Deputies of Heartbreak called Salmon Salad Boogie. Find it at Bandcamp/Sheriff Lone Star.